Good evening. Thank you very much for coming this evening for our program on Judaism and Journalism Ethics, the Ethics of a Free and Independent Press. I am Mordechai Torchiner, and I'm grateful that you're all here for our second annual supporting member program. I also want to note that this is actually the beginning of the seventh year for our Beit Midrash, which is extremely startling for me to realize, really, Baruch Shachianu, that we're here today. Thank God that we've been able to do this and that the program has been supported by the community as wonderfully as it has. The supporting member program is dedicated in memory of Dov Bill Rubinstein, Dov Ben Mordechai, in whose memory the Beit Midrash was initially founded, hence our name, Beit Midrash Zichron Dov. And Dov's daughter, Rochelle Rubinstein, will speak at the end to give us a sense of the values of Bill Rubinstein and the way that drives, in fact, what we do in our Beit Midrash. I want to thank Yeshivat Or Chaim for providing the space for the program this evening, the Avreichim, as well as their wives, who helped to set up and to handle registration, and Dan and Karen Walter as well for helping. And I especially want to thank Yoni Goldstein for being a good sport and agreeing to sit on the panel along with Rabbi Ziering. The impetus for this program. There was an Ipsos Reid poll that came out last fall regarding the most trusted careers in Canada. So this was great. They rated professionals on a scale of 1 to 7, 7 being most trustworthy. 77% of Canadians gave firefighters a high rating of 6 or 7. 69% had such trust for nurses. 65% for doctors. 58% for Canadian soldiers. You know where this is going. 52% for teachers. 46% for police officers. 42% for judges. 35% for psychologists. 30% for chiropractors. 28% for plumbers. I just read the numbers. 24% for church leaders, 22% for financial advisors, 18% for journalists. Journalists did beat out auto mechanics at 16%, CEOs at 11%, and telemarketers at 4%. God bless the Huffington Post. So, why don't people trust journalists? You know, presumably, one reason people have a hard time is because we read journalists saying things and voicing opinions that we may not agree with. And if someone says something I don't agree with, well, then I don't trust him. In all seriousness, that's part of it, I think. Another is that sometimes journalists seem to be trying to sell certain ideas or to sell their media, whatever the media happens to be. And people have a native distrust for someone when they feel that person is trying to sell them something. But a major factor, from my perspective, is that journalists are engaged in a trade that challenges traditional ethics, including halachic ethics. Journalism challenges basic values, privacy, trust, positive speech. There's an ad that I hear on the radio from time to time, something like, we're cruising your neighborhood, finding out what's going on and telling everybody all about it. And I shudder when I hear that. I don't want you telling everybody all about it. But it raises questions, questions about whether one can trust. And so tonight, what we're going to do is to pose ethical questions to our two panelists who each have a special expertise in journalism in the Jewish community. Yoni Goldstein, editor of the Canadian Jewish News, and Rabbi Jonathan Ziering, a serious Talmud Chacham Torah scholar who has done significant work in the field of journalism and Jewish ethics. There's a possibility, incidentally, of an ongoing series on the topic of journalism ethics for after the holidays. And if that's something that interests you, please make sure to see me afterwards. I'm also planning on emailing out people who signed in at the door, so we'll be able to follow up that way. A little bit of background on our panelists. And this is what Yoni sent me, so I apologize for the brevity of it, but Yoni was very terse. Yoni Goldstein is the editor of the Canadian Jewish News, where he writes a weekly column. His work has been published in the National Post, Globe and Mail, Maclean's, Haaretz, and the Wall Street Journal. Rabbi Jonathan Ziering attended Yeshivat Har Etzion, the Gush, after high school. He received his BA from Yeshiva College in Philosophy and Jewish Studies. his MA from the Bernard Revel Graduate School in Jewish Philosophy, his ordination from REITS, the rabbinical arm of Yeshiva University. Following his studies in YU, he returned to Yeshivat Har Etzion as a member of the Kollel Gavoa for Advanced Studies. He also taught there. He functioned as a rabbinic resource for the overseas students. He has been a fellow in Yeshiva University's Center for Jewish Law and Contemporary Civilization at Cardozo Law School. He has also been a fellow with the Tikva Fund. He has been editor of Yeshiva University's Magazine of Jewish Thought, Kol HaMavaser, editor-in-chief of Yeshiva University's Torah Journal, Beit Yitzchak. Many of his classes are available on yutorah.org. I highly recommend them. He blogged some of his Torah thoughts at Shah Shu'im. And when he was at the Tikva Fund, Rabbi Ziering developed an extensive theory of journalistic ethics from a halachic perspective. Rabbi Ziering is our incoming Sgan, for those who remember, Rabbi Azariah Berzon, and then Rabbi Baruch Weintraub. So that's the position that Rabbi Ziering now has. He's living in Thornhill and is also the incoming rabbinic assistant at the Bayit. So those are our two panelists. The way the program will run is that I have several questions for the panelists. I shared the questions with them a couple of weeks ago. We're not surprising people. Each panelist will have a few minutes to respond to the question and to each other. After those questions are done, we'll take questions from the floor. Yisrael Meir Rosenzweig is where? Over there. And Rabbi David Ali Grunland is in the back over there. They're both Avreichim with our Beit Midrash. And they each have index cards. If you have a question that you would like to ask, you know, they're going to be circulating with cards, and you'll be able to take a card and to write it, and they'll bring the card to me. Without further ado, then I will launch into our first question. Question number one is about the positives. Journalism is viewed, as I said in the beginning, with some mistrust in much of the Jewish community and even beyond. But let's start with the positives. What are three ways in which journalism contributes positively to society? And I'll ask Yoni Goldstein to take this one first.
Thank you. Before I start, first of all, thank you, Rabbi Torchiner and Rabbi Ziering and the YU Kollel for having me. I've spent a lot of years in this room. I was a student at the yeshiva. I grew up in this neighborhood. I've dove in here on Shabbos for most of my young adult life, and it's a little bit weird to be standing on this side of. So I'm still working with that in my head, but I'll try and answer the questions as best I can. I think there's a lot of positive that journalism and journalists can do. Jewish journalists and journalists in general. If we're keeping it to three things or three general areas that journalists can do, I'd start with saying journalists inform and educate. If you read a newspaper, or increasingly if you read news online or on blogs, you're generally learning things you didn't know before, or maybe new opinions or new perspectives on things you thought you knew before. And for me, that continuing education is an important part of life, and it's an important part of knowledge gaining and knowledge making. And then we go out and we share that knowledge with other people, and that makes us all smarter and more informed. I can't think of a more honorable thing really to be doing. A second point that I think journalism does very powerfully is it empowers people. And I'll tell you about this from a personal experience in two ways. One, growing up, I never really felt like I had very much of a voice or much of an opinion or much of an impetus for whatever opinions I had to make them public. But working as a journalist, it's given me a degree of confidence to be able to go out and say, here's what I think, and I want to know what you think. And we can talk about those things and either convince each other of something that we didn't think we could be convinced of before, or at the very least, engage in a dialogue and a debate where hopefully we learn from each other. And related to that, and I see this all the time at the CJN, there are far more people than any of us would ever expect who are excellent writers. Excellent writing comes in all kinds of different forms. It comes in very personal narrative writing. It comes in analysis. It comes in opinions. It comes in news reporting. Really all sorts of different ways. And there's a ton of untapped potential when it comes to writing specifically, and journalism as well. I hear from people all the time. I get emails from people I've never spoken to before, or people will call me up on the phone and say, I've written this thing, I'm not sure if it's very good, can I send it to you? And maybe you'll take a look and tell me what you think, give me some pointers. And I'm blown away. About half of the writing we have in the paper on a weekly basis is from people who I never knew could write before. And now they've become regulars. And I know from my interactions with them that it's given them a voice, it's given them confidence, and in some cases it's given them a whole new perspective on their lives. And I think that's a really important aspect of what we do. It's not just the reporters and editors who are working on a daily basis who are contributing to journalism and to writing in general. It's all kinds of people. And I'm sure there are lots of people in the room right now who are more than capable of writing for the CJN, for their own blogs, for any other number of publications. And while I'm at it, I'll just give a little bit of a cheap plug. If you have something that you want to say, I'm always open to reading it. So that's the second thing. And the third, which is also a very powerful and important, is journalism reduces boundaries. I find that it brings people together even when they're disagreeing, especially in nonpartisan publications like the CJN. I know we'll talk a little bit later about partisanship in journalism, and it is a serious issue, but not in all cases. And the CJN is a really good example of a place where we don't have a particular political bent, we don't have a particular cultural or sociological view. We're more interested in telling people what everybody else is doing. And hopefully you learn something from that as well. And in the process, we're building a community and we're reducing boundaries. And all of us know that there are any number of boundaries in the Jewish community that separate people. And one of our goals is to eliminate those as best we can. And if we can do that by you reading three different perspectives on the Parsha, as an example, or hearing a Reform and an Orthodox rabbi discuss Unetane Tokef, which is in this week's edition of the CJN, I think we're doing something very positive.
We're going to have to do this every time. I've gotten used to this problem. I'd like to reiterate the thanks to Rabbi Turchiner for being the moderator, and to Yoni for agreeing to discuss this with us. So, three positives about journalism. This time, I guess from the Jewish perspective. I'll start with what I had as the last one, but it'll pick up on something that Yoni mentioned. So, Yoni mentioned that one of the positives of journalism is that it educates people, it empowers them, it allows them to communicate with each other. So this is actually a theme that's been picked up a lot by rabbinic scholars in Israel. Here and there I'm going to quote some Israeli scholars as we go along. They've spoken more about this issue for obvious reasons. Canada or the States or anywhere outside of Israel, if there were no Jewish journalists, so maybe we wouldn't know what's going on in the Jewish community, but community would be informed. But in Israel, that's not the case. In Israel, where the majority is Jewish, if there weren't Jews being journalists, then there wouldn't be journalism. So there's been a much stronger impetus for rabbinic scholars in Israel to grapple with the questions of, well, how do we approach journalism? What are the positives? What are the negatives? So one of the positives that several scholars there have raised, for example, Reviewer Yuval Shurlo in his article in Tchumen, volume 27, is what Yoni said, is that he sees a great benefit in society in general, and even more so in a democratic society, and he assumes, as do many rabbinic scholars, that there's a value in Israel being both Jewish and democratic. And if that's the case, that there's a benefit to democracy, and democracy is predicated on people being involved, then that must be a religious value for people to have some sort of communication and some vehicle by which they can communicate with the general public. And they can know what's going on. They can be informed citizens. And this is as important as it is outside of Israel. If you know anything about Israeli politics, parties disappear and reappear overnight. And those parties don't get two seats, they get 10 seats in the Knesset. It's very important that people follow the news. And In Israel, if you have spent any significant amount of time there, you'll know that people read the news all the time. Your average person knows what's going on, the ins and outs of the Knesset. They know what party was created last night, whether that be, you know, Kahlon's Kulanu party, which swept with it 10 seats just running on the housing issue, or, you know, several years ago it'd be the joint legalization of marijuana / Holocaust survivor party. That's Israel for you. So I think that issue that Yoni raised is something that Jewish law very much values, the ability of people to communicate so that they can be part of society and build society. So that's number one. The second thing I would say, and this focuses, I think, on investigative journalism. Actually, my next 2 points, I'm going to focus on investigative journalism. The reason I chose to focus on it, and I'm actually glad Yoni didn't choose to focus on it, is because most people, when they think about halacha and journalism, they think first and foremost about Lashon Hara. Yoni knows, he glanced at a paper I wrote where I attempted to sort of reframe the issue. But when we talk about Lashon Hara and the negatives, most often we're talking about investigative journalism, journalism which is telling negative stories about people who admittedly did negative things. So I know Rabbi Turchiner said we're not talking about the negatives, so I will not get into what I think about how we deal with the halachic problems, which is something we do have to grapple with. But that being said, since that's the one that gets the most negative press, pardon the pun, in the halachic community, I think it's important to put two positives on the table for investigative journalism. So the first, and this comes out of a Gemara in Yoma 86b. The Gemara there says, "Mefarsimin es achanifin." We have a commandment to publicize chanifin. It's hard to translate, but let's say hypocrites. The way the Rishonim understand it, the way the medieval commentaries understand it, people who present themselves one way and behind closed doors, they do something else. And the Gemara says, why? Mipnei chilul Hashem. Because otherwise it would be a desecration of God's name. And there's a dispute amongst the commentaries, what is the desecration of God's name? But at least one position that emerges from Rashi and from others is that the existence of hypocrisy, of people who present themselves as, let's say, upstanding politicians who are just there to help you, to help the people, when in fact they are not, right? In fact, they're in it for themselves, or in fact, they're corrupt. It's not that it's going to lead to a desecration of God's name. The existence of hypocrisy in society is itself a violation of God's presence in this world, a desecration of God's presence, and needs to be rooted out. So one possibility, one positive in investigative journalism, is that it helps us remove this chilul Hashem, this desecration of God's name. Related to that is my next point, is that it creates, even if no one's doing anything wrong, the existence of a press that is, what do you say, driving through your community to let you know what's going on and tell the world, is that it creates accountability. And while the Talmudic perspective on accountability is a little bit complicated, suffice it to say that the way the tradition has developed from the Talmud through the modern commentaries, primarily the Rama, Rav Moshe Israelis, the primary Ashkenazi decisor, is that all leaders have a responsibility to the community to provide accountability in some way, because they have an obligation, which the Talmud bases on a verse, that you should be clean, you should be considered upright in the eyes of God and of people. The Talmud says that what you learn from here, what you derive from here, is that people not just have to be honest, but they need to create a framework in which people know they're honest so they can trust them. So creating accountability even when people aren't doing anything wrong. But the fact that there is a potential, they know that if they do something wrong, someone will catch them, means that when they're not doing something wrong, there's a greater ability for people to trust them, which again is also something that the Talmud values. So those would be my three. I don't know if Yoni agrees, disagrees. Are we doing response if people want, or move on to the next question? Okay.
Question number two takes us a little bit away from the positives. The privacy imperative. John Schwartz, reporter for the New York Times, has written, "Newspaper reporters are people with an eye for unusual facts. We live for the moment when we know something other people don't. Something that we can tell everybody that will knock them back. On the other hand, the Talmud says, if someone tells you something, you're not allowed to retell it to other people without explicit permission. Can you reconcile the impulse of journalism to report with the impulse of Judaism to maintain privacy? And I'll ask Rabbi Ziering to speak first.
We kept it at the right height. That's great. So this one's a little bit more complicated from a halachic perspective. Right? Does halacha value, or does Jewish ethics value this impulse, right, to find the unknown, to be able to tell it to the public, to find that scoop and publicize it to the world? So I'll say, and this is I think a classic answer for anyone who knows my teachers, Josh, this will mean a lot to Reb Gutenberg. Yes and no. I think it depends what you mean by that impulse. If the impulse we're talking about is the impulse to be the one who broke the story, you just get that thrill out of breaking, you know, I found that he did a crime and now I got to tell everybody because everyone's going to remember me as the person who broke, I don't know, Watergate. Or, you know, if people follow America, what is it, all the other gates that have now are in Snowgate and Bridgegate and whatever gates there are in the world. So that, I think, halacha would have very mixed perspectives on. The Chavetz Chaim in his magnum opus, in his eponymous work, the Chavetz Chaim, lists seven conditions for justifying lashon hara litoelet, lashon hara, things that would otherwise be gossip but are permitted. And without getting to all seven, one of them is that in order for us to legitimate speaking badly about others, even when it's positive, you got to remove the personal thrill from it, right? If, you know, there's somebody I don't like, I don't like him because he's a bad person. You know, he's a mean person. But I never realized how bad. And then I discover a story about him, and I know it's going to ruin his life. So it may be that the public needs to find out, but I got to take a step back, and I can't break the story because I want to take him down. Right? That is a negative. So if that's the impulse we're talking about, then I would say halacha really wouldn't be behind it. But there's another one, and I think this came out of Yoni's remarks before, there's another impulse, which is not that I want to take somebody down, I want to just break the story, but it's that I take pride in the ability to enable the public, to protect the public, to spread information that needs to be conveyed to the public. In halacha, for example, let's say someone's really embezzling money, and we need to stop it, and we need to publicize it, that would be a fulfillment of the command, lo ta'amod al dam re'echa, right? Don't stand idly by while your brother's blood is being shed, or his, many commentaries point out, or his money is being lost, right? Damim can mean either, can mean blood or money. If the impulse we're talking about is not, oh, I want to take him down, but I have a responsibility, and I get to be the one who helps people, so that impulse, right, that impulse is something that I think that Torah would embrace. So again, if I wanted to distinguish the two types of impulse, one would be something that I think halacha would frown on, and then some of the impulses that Yoni mentioned I think would be something that halacha really would look very favorably upon.
Just to illustrate the John Schwartz column that Rabbi Torchiner was speaking about a moment ago, that journalists loved those moments where they know something that nobody else does. I was at a candidates debate last night, and candidates from all four of the parties in a riding just south of here, and they were all debating their ideas, and generally fairly predictable in what they said. But the moment that stood out for me, and I spoke to a couple of people today to see if they had noticed it also, just to prove to myself that it was one of those little things that journalists tend to notice, was There were bottles of water up on the stage for all of the candidates to use. And at one point, the liberal candidate magnanimously tried to pass a bottle of water over to the Green candidate, who looked at it in horror, to say, how can I drink out of this plastic bottle? And then motioned to the Liberal candidate that he had his stainless steel water container at the ground. And she was horrified back, and she had not thought of this before. And so these are, yes, it's very true. These are the moments that you sort of revel in and you tend to notice more than other people. And you wait for moments like this to share them with everybody else. I'm glad you said that the answer was yes and no to the privacy issue, because I struggled with that a lot, and really I couldn't find a reason to say yes. So I'm glad there is a halachic reason, a halachic basis for it. I'll tell you, and this is also an election-related related story, but it deals with the privacy issue. About a week and a half ago, we broke a story about the conservative candidate in this riding, Mark Adler, contrary to what he was advertising, he is not the first child of Holocaust survivors to be an MP. And we'd known about this for a few weeks. We had notified people about it in an attempt to have it taken down. And when that didn't happen, we went ahead with the story. And this gets to your point about why you put out stories like this. Do you do it to say, look at us, we knew something that nobody else did, and we've made our own impression on the public? Or are we doing it for some larger public good? I think we did it for a larger public good, although my concern to this day remains that it was taken out of context, or out of the meaning that we intended. The meaning we intended was, here is a fact about a candidate in an election that is untrue, and we want to set the record straight. What some people took that to mean, and I've had conversations about this, was that we were saying candidates should not tell their constituents that of their relationship to the Holocaust, which is entirely not what we were saying, and we clarified it the next week. I actually think that it's a perfectly logical thing for a candidate, especially in a riding like this, to say, I have a particular sensitivity to the Holocaust. Many of you will have that same sensitivity, and it's important that somebody with that sensitivity represents all of you in the House of Commons. So that just sort of gets to your point that sometimes the line between doing something for your own good and doing something for the public's good can be blurred and be misinterpreted. So I think you're always walking that line, and you're always worried that it's going to be misinterpreted that way. Some other privacy-related things I'll get to very quickly. There are issues that are brought to our attention, like the Adler story, where we say to ourselves, if we don't run this story, what happens? Will it just die? Will nobody ever know? In which case, that comes with its own ethical issues. But on the other hand, if we don't run the story and somebody else finds out, which is in my mind entirely likely, and let's say the Toronto Star finds out, and then they run the story, are they going to run it in a different way than we do that will be more damaging, not necessarily to the candidate, but to the Jewish community in general? And in that case, is it our responsibility specifically to run the story so that somebody else doesn't? All of that said, there are certain stories, actually not certain, there are many stories that are entirely private in nature and that we would never touch. The litmus test is very simple. Is there any community good to be done from telling this story? And if there isn't, if it's just people in a family fighting, if it's just couple of businessmen squabbling at each other, and we get calls about this all the time, then we generally say thank you, but we're really not interested in the story, and it's not the kind of thing we would do. So again, I guess the answer really is yes and no. It depends on the reasons why you're doing the story, and it depends how you do it as well. If you do it in the right way and you express what you're actually trying to get out of it, then yes, those issues can be reconciled. But if you don't explain it the right way, and if it comes across as just being a matter of pushing yourself out into the fray, trying to get a little bit of press for your own upstart publication, then that would be something I would be very wary of.
Thank you.
a little bit more in terms of the privacy theme and the issue of airing dirty communal laundry. Jewish law has a long history of not trusting the authorities of the broader non-Jewish community. We have severe laws regarding Mesira, turning Jews over to the police in certain situations, not to be discussed at length right now. That requires really its own program. But our history has taught us to fear what those who hate us will do if they are empowered to harm us. We're also taught to prevent Chilul Hashem, to avoid portraying Judaism in a bad light. At the same time, journalism preaches that sunlight is the best disinfectant, and on those grounds, journalists divulge information about citizens and institutions if they believe that it affects the public interest. How should a Jewish newspaper walk the line between reporting wrongdoing and performing acts of Mesira and Chilul Hashem? And I will ask Yoni to speak first.
Since the election is ongoing and really on, I'm sure, everybody's minds, I'll tie this into the election as well. A story I'm sure many of you are familiar with, if not all of you. There was a protest. Well, I'll go back a little bit farther. A couple of weeks ago, emails started circulating to me. I've received them at least a dozen times now, probably more. One member of the Jewish community sent an email to another member of the Jewish community excoriating him and his wife for hosting a fundraising event for Justin Trudeau and the liberal candidate in this riding, Michael Levitt. And the email was strongly worded, to say the least. It invoked the Holocaust. It insulted in a number of ways the hosts of the fundraiser. Incidentally, there was a response email from the host of the fundraiser, which was passed around far less often, as far as I can tell. I think I received that once or twice. I'm sure there are some of you who haven't seen that at all. The first email, though, I'm sure many people saw. So we had those emails in our hands, and we were debating what to do with it. Do we tell the story of these emails, and then as the story escalated, that there would be a protest outside of the location of the Trudeau fundraiser by anti-Trudeau, pro-Harper conservative supporters, that they would be protesting outside the house on the night of the fundraiser. We knew about this. We were trying to figure out whether we should do it or not. In the end, we actually were not the first outlet to report on this. Somebody did it before us, another smaller Jewish paper, which sort of forced our hands. But we thought long and hard about whether this was the sort of thing we should do. And ultimately, I think the decision we came to was, and we'll get to this again later on, but this has to be done. There has to be some positive outcome of us doing this. If we're just out there saying, here's what's happening, isn't this crazy? We've got pictures of the event and we've got pictures of the protesters and angry people. How does that help the community? What does that do? What does that do to lower the volume, to lower the anger, to try and bring people together? And so what we decided to do was, in addition to telling the news side of it, of this is what is actually happening, there will be a protest by Jews protesting other Jews over their politics, we decided to run in 3 weeks in a row, opinion columns that suggested ways that the community could come back together. No matter whether you were a conservative supporter or a liberal supporter or an NDP or Green supporter or whether you don't vote at all, to find ways to lower the volume and to try and impress on people the need for political debate to be polite and to not become personal. So I guess part of my answer to the question is these are stories that we do think long and hard about whether to run or not. But even if we are running them, there has to be some sort of positive community-building aspect to it. And I think I was actually telling the writer, Michael Diamond, who wrote a column 2 weeks ago in the newspaper about this and the need for bringing people together, that it was one of the proudest moments I've had working at the CJN over the last year and 6 or 7 months. I really felt like we did something powerful and we were actually able to do something really important and good for the community. I'd raise one other point on this matter. Yes, it's true. We have every reason to worry that if we are reporting on bad things that Jews do, that the people who hate Jews are going to take that and throw it against us in some way or another. It happens, and it will continue to happen. But there's another side of anti-Semitism, which is that there's this Jewish cabal, a secretive cabal that's controlling the world and it has, you know, and doesn't answer to anybody. And part of what I feel is that by telling these stories, as difficult as they are, we are in our own ways sort of knocking down the conspiracy. It's a little bit of an indirect way of doing it by saying we're actually not these terrible people. We do bad things also. but in its own way, I think it is a powerful message.
Okay, I'll try to speak briefly to it. First, let me just bracket out one of the issues that Reuter Chiner mentioned, why I think it's, as he mentioned, not fully relevant. But I want to just highlight in what ways it is and what ways it isn't. So he mentioned that the rules of Mesirah, the prohibition of handing over a Jew to a non-Jewish government under certain circumstances, seems to indicate that there's a certain lack of trust in allowing our issues to get out of the community. So first I'd just like to point out, and Reuter Chiner I think alluded to this a little bit, that many decisors have noted that classically that law applied in governments which were not fair, right? Where, you know, for a minor crime someone could be thrown into a pit without food or water for the rest of his life, or the short rest of his life. And many decisors, the late Rabbi Vosner, Rabbi Usher Weiss, claimed that for that reason, in a fair government, we don't have the problem of Mesirah, or at least it's greatly mitigated. And that, I think, is a dominant position. But what it indicates is that we have to recognize the situation we're living in is different than much of the precedent that we're going to be using in halachic literature. And the second one on the Mesirah issue is that the analogy between handing someone over to the government or publicizing something to the press, trying them, so to speak, in the papers, isn't exact, and it cuts in both ways. On the one hand, handing someone over to a government, assuming you think that it's permitted in the current sort of political situation, in certain ways is going to make handing someone over to the police less problematic than using the press, because the reason that we consider the government fair is because there's a process of law, and the papers have much lower standards, as ethical as they might be, right? Innocent until proven guilty is not the standards of the press. So at some level, I think, you know, airing dirty laundry is going to be more problematic in the current society than Mesirah, ironically. On the other hand, there are certain things that don't belong in court, right? There are certain things that are immoral, if not illegal, which are still necessary for the public to know. So I think the analogy, I think, a little bit breaks down, but where it breaks down, we see sort of the benefits and problems with using the press to air dirty laundry. On the one hand, the standards are lower, but on the other hand, it allows us to have a vehicle to deal with things that are not illegal but are necessary for the public to know. The second point I want to make really very briefly, you mentioned Chilul Hashem, and I think the desecration of God's name, and this is really where I think the issue lies. Often you hear in the Jewish community, don't air the dirty laundry because it's a Chilul Hashem. It'll cause a desecration of God's name. If we return to the passage I mentioned before, that we expose hypocrites because of the desecration of God's name, we notice something interesting, and I heard this from Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, the son of Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik, not the other one, in the name of his father, which is, if you look at the Gemara, something very clear emerges. We publicize hypocrisy because the hypocrisy is a desecration of God's name. And based on this, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik noted that it's not the publicizing that is the Chilul Hashem. Once the crime or the immorality and the corruption exists, right, that was the Chilul Hashem. The guilty party was the one who is responsible. How we deal with it, right? It's not necessarily a Chilul Hashem just because it's now going to look worse. It's not the fault of the people who have to deal with the situation. The only thing we do have to take into account, and I'm glad that Yoni mentioned this, is we have to decide whether the best way to do it is through the press. And that, Halach has many things to say, as does general journalistic ethics, and I think many of the things I would say, Yoni already said. But basically, yeah, you know, if it's time to publicize something or to deal with it, then really the question should be asking is, what's the best way? And there are many factors we'll have to discuss, but not for now. But I think basically Yoni's answer would align with what I would say.
Thank you. One more sort of privacy-related question. Journalistic codes of ethics require that journalists protect the privacy of third parties when reporting people's behavior. In a Jewish community, though, readers regularly interact with the subjects of articles, as well as with their parents, their spouses, their children, and it's really impossible to avoid harming innocent third parties. When is a Jewish community newspaper entitled to put the public interest ahead of the interests of innocent third parties? Rabbi Zirin.
Okay, so I'm glad I got to answer this one first, primarily because I already built up most of my answer in my previous remarks. I mentioned before the distinction that one would have to draw between issues that are dealt with through the court system and things that are dealt with through the court of public opinion, so to speak. And I think returning to the differences will help answer this question. In the court, right, in the judicial system, Jewish law, as opposed to modern Western law, which not for now, but scholars have noted, really emerges from the Greek tradition. If people are familiar with the writings of Socrates and Plato and the defense that he launched at his trial. Right, the Western notion that courts are supposed to have mercy on third parties and not exact justice really starts with the Greeks and continues through Western thought, but isn't found in Jewish law. Jewish law really says no. When someone has to be punished, so you punish them. You don't take into account their children, their family, who's going to be hurt. That's on their head. And that's in the courts because there's a responsibility to exact justice. But as we mentioned before, journalism and the court of public opinion has different goals and therefore different standards. And as we noted, since the goal of journalism is to improve society using the vehicle of information, and as we both said, that the litmus test that they need to use when deciding is this positive for society, I think the same question is going to be true here, is that we simply have to ask the question, yes, if possible, we should avoid hurting third parties. No, we shouldn't let that stop us if it's absolutely necessary to publicize the information. And the question we're just going to have to ask is, since our goal in publicizing information is to sort of bring about the best good for society, we need to balance those competing goals, those competing goods. If there's a different way, sure. If not, then sometimes we're going to have to publicize the information, even if that hurts third parties. And I think, again, that highlights the difference between the courts and the press, where sort of it's because it works on a different mechanism, it has to ask different questions to figure out the ethical thing to do.
I think Rabbi Zering's answer was excellent there. So I'm going to maybe take this in a slightly different direction because I don't have much to add on that side of it. Innocent third parties, though, can mean a bunch of different things. Obviously, it can mean people who are affected by a story. It can also mean people who are telling you the story in the first place. So if somebody comes to me and says, person X is doing something really bad and we need to tell everybody about it, but I don't want my name. I don't want my name put out there because that's going to hurt me and that's going to hurt my family. So what do you do then? And that leads into a fairly significant journalistic question, which is using anonymous sources. I think you're seeing more and more of this in investigative journalism specifically, But, you know, in general, it's become more of a trend as well. And we've done quite a bit of it, and we're continuing to do it. This was something I thought long and hard about when I first started at the CJN, and decided with the help of the editors and reporters there that it was something we could do as well. We could use anonymous sources. It means that there's a higher level of accuracy necessary. It means we have to do extra checking. It means we generally have to speak to more people to make sure the story is verifiable. But I think as a way of protecting people, it's something I'm comfortable with. I know not everybody is comfortable with it, but I am comfortable with it. And I think that's one way we can help protect people who might otherwise not be willing to come forward and tell us what they're seeing. And if they're not doing that, that leads to a whole other series of problems and negates a lot of the positives we talked about at the beginning. Also, one other related thing. This mostly has to do with the rise of the internet and Google searches. Nowadays, if you tell a story about somebody, and let's say it's about somebody doing something bad, although that's not the only example. If you tell a story about somebody doing a crime, let's say the crime was committed 5 years ago. This person might very well have paid for their crime, either by going to jail or paying a fine. Their lives have in many ways likely been destroyed, lost their jobs, possibly lost their families as well. And now they're coming to us and saying, I paid my dues, and I can't get on with my life because your story still shows up anytime I do a Google search. Will you take the story off of the internet? Will you take it out of your archives? Because it's continuing to ruin my life long after it should. And this is a really difficult question because, on the one hand, we're not in the business of scrubbing history. The work was done. What happened, happened. We can't undo that. We can't change it. On the other hand, we want to have some pity on people who deserve a second chance. We've come across this, I'd say, 5 or 6 times in the last year and a half. And our answer we have not had a consistent answer. We found it extremely difficult to find one rule that would stick for all these cases, where we could apply this rule and it would work in all the cases. So in the end, we take these on a case-by-case basis. But this is something that journalists never really had to deal with in the past. This is a fairly new issue, and one that's not going to go away, because now everything that's written is literally there forever, and that's not going to change. It's only going to become more there everywhere. So I'm not entirely sure what the answer to that question is, other than taking it on a case-by-case basis. But this is another way where nominally guilty but perhaps now innocent people might have a claim on us changing our history.
Don't get comfortable. I want to ask you a follow-up. In terms of the point you raised at the end regarding the archives that are available online, why wouldn't you apply the same principle that you apply for news stories? In other words, when a story is new, you mentioned earlier, you think about, is this to the benefit of the community? Is this something that has to be done, and how should it be done? Should it be done in this way? You know, a careful evaluation of the needs. Why not use that as a standard, as opposed to the standard of we're not in the business of scrubbing history?
So again, it's really a difficult issue, and I should have clarified. It's not only people who have committed crimes and now are trying to put their lives back together. We hear from people who say, "You did a profile of me 5 years ago, but now my religious outlook has changed. I'm living an entirely different life, and what you wrote about doesn't really reflect who I am anymore." It might actually be hurting my ability to get a job or to find a husband or a wife. Again, I'm not sure what the answer to this question, really is. Yes, it's in the public service and in the public good to have these stories out there, especially if it's somebody who has done something wrong, and we might be able to keep that person from further doing something wrong. But I think there's also an impetus to say people can change. And we want to be able to encourage them to change, especially when they're changing from something bad to potentially something good.
For our next question, I'm actually going to incorporate a question that was submitted, since it has an actual case. advocacy and bias. There's a school of thought, I suppose, within journalism that says that a journalist can engage in advocacy journalism, promoting a particular point of view and still practicing journalism responsibly and honestly. And this allows newspapers to run articles which they say tell the truth and simultaneously press for a particular agenda. I might use this question later. It's going to make it too long. But within Jewish law, on the other hand, there's little trust for a partial observer, such as in the roles of witnesses or judges, since we used the court analogy before. Do you believe it is possible for a newspaper to promote a particular perspective in a given issue and still report the facts of that issue impartially? Yoni.
So the short answer to the question is entirely yes. Working at the National Post, which is a right-of-center newspaper, and that was where I really started out, I saw it on a daily basis. You have a paper that has a particular political, sociological, cultural bent, but I think does a very good job not only of reporting both sides of a story, but also offering opinions on both sides of the story. Now, I'll admit that there are any number of reasons why this practically doesn't actually work out, and all you have to do is watch cable news in the States or even read your Israeli newspapers to see how it doesn't work out. It can be difficult, and the news telling can be clouded by opinion. But I think particularly it can actually be done, and in some places it is done. Now, there's a second question, which is whether it should be done, and I don't think so. I actually think that one of the reasons that newspapers are dying, aside from the internet, which none of them ever planned for, is partisanship. Nowadays, let's say you're a reader of Canadian politics, you need to read 3, 4, 5 publications on a daily basis to sort of get all sides of the news, to feel like you're informed about what everybody thinks about everything. And that to me is a major mistake in newsmaking. What you should be doing is offering all those things in one place. That way, nobody has to go to any other publication. You can give everything to the reader in one place. I don't understand why more publications haven't done this yet, but I'm very happy that the CJN has done this. We don't have take a particular position really on anything other than general support for Israel, general support for the Jewish community in Canada, and the diaspora entirely. But all of the minutiae within there, and there are tons of them, we want to offer people as many different opinions as possible. We want to be effectively a one-stop shop. You can come to us and know that you're going to get the full story because we're not partisan. We don't have anything in the game other than to inform you. So I think partisan publications can do a very good job of accurately telling the news, although often they don't. I just don't see the reason why that should be the case anymore, especially in a time when newspapers are dying. I think the first newspaper, Canadian newspaper, that figures this out, and if any of you just tell them it was my idea, this will be the one that might be the one paper that actually survives the internet generation.
Now we've Yoni and I have, I think, agreed on a lot of things, which is nice. I'm just going to bracket this. We don't have time, but we should discuss it later. Going back to the point of anonymous sourcing, which is something I didn't mention, there I actually have a strong opinion where I disagree, but that's for a discussion for another time, maybe for the follow-up series. But it's something I would want to discuss. To this question, so I hadn't thought too much about advocacy journalism until Rabbi Turchiner sent along the question, the article, which described what it was. And I don't know if I have strong opinions on it. I'm a little bit ambivalent on the issue, so I just want to make a few comments that would point in some directions. Rabbi Turchiner noted that Jewish law is very suspect of people with particular interest in a situation, and brought the example from the court system, from witnesses, where we say that a witness has to be an observer, an independent, non-biased observer, and not a party to the issue. And that's true, and we definitely suspect bias, but just a few points to keep in mind that sort of push in the opposite direction. One point which was made in this article is that, well, everyone has some sort of bias, and if everyone's going to speak with bias, it's better that they're upfront about it than pretend that they're not biased and are actually biased. So that much I agree with. I don't know if that means we should have advocacy journalism as a positive, but it's definitely better to have someone being open about their position than pretending they're being objective and not. That much I think is true from common sense. The article also noted that good advocacy journalism requires you to be honest even when it's to your detriment. And that, I think, again, if we're going to endorse it, is definitely going to be true. Again, if we're going to justify journalism based on the fact that it provides a public good, then we have to be honest, right? We, you know, some have suggested that one of the benefits of journalism is that it acts as a to fulfill the commandment of rebuke, right? That it sees a problem and it teaches people to improve. If you're not willing to improve your own side, then it's just not going to work. So again, I don't know whether that means it's a good thing or bad, but if we're going to do it, it's definitely true that you have to be willing to speak badly, even about your side, even if you have a bias and are open about it. Still, you can't hide the detriments of your own side. Another thing I would just note is that, you know, sometimes people take positions because they think they're correct. Right? No one would call it advocacy journalism if you support a politician because you think that one is a criminal and one is not, and you support the non-criminal, right? This happened, you know, I grew up in Staten Island. This was very famous in the news that there were two candidates. One was being indicted for 20 counts and threatened on television to take the journalist, break him in half, and throw him off the roof. He won in a landslide by 20%. But sometimes people do take positions, so because they think they're correct. So again, is that advocacy? I don't know. But sometimes that's, you know, sometimes there's going to be a fine line between advocating for a position because it's, you know, your political party and advocating for a position because you think it's right. One of those is better than the other, and it may not be under the rubric of advocacy journalism, but I think is something that is potentially positive. And the last point I would just note is that while Reischer Chiner is correct that with regard to witnesses, we don't like bias, halacha recognizes in many other circumstances that people are capable of being honest even when they're biased. For example, there's a dispute, but the majority of halachic decisors rule that a rabbi is allowed to rule on his own halachic decisions, you know, things that relate to himself. Because, you know, we make decisions for ourselves every day. We're sort of biased, right? We try to take a third-party perspective and not be swayed by our biases. But we have to make decisions, and the same is true in halacha, and the same is true in everything in life. So, you know, I don't think it's necessarily the case, as Yoni mentioned, that if someone's an advocate, they're going to be dishonest. Again, I don't know whether it's a good idea. I'm really ambivalent, but those are just some things to think about.
So at this point, I'm going to drop the couple of questions that I had left in the interest of taking some of the questions that have been submitted. I thank everyone who submitted questions. I can't take all of them, so I'm trying to take the ones that I think will expand the conversation and add to what's been said. We are planning again at the end. Rochelle Rubenstein is going to speak about her father and whose memory the program is dedicated, the Rubenstein. And then there will be Maariv as well afterwards. First question that I'm going to take here, and this one really I think goes to Rabbi Ziering, regarding airing communal dirty laundry. Does the inclination often voiced not to, quote, air dirty laundry prefer those who commit misdeeds over their potential victims? It seems that a community that does not publicize misdeeds will be mistakenly compliant. Awareness of problems is probably a prerequisite for the development of policies to protect vulnerable community members. If that's true, do you think it's important for that awareness to be spread down the ranks to all, or can rabbinic and community leaders be trusted to respond to the information appropriately?
You can write short questions, too.
Can I look at the question?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. The short answer is yes, that was the implication of what I said. I think, yes, that the the use of the halachot of Lashon Hara as often an excuse to not publicize actual corruption, actual abuse, yes, favors the abuser over the victim, which is the point that I quoted before from Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik. I think that continues to be true. I think that that message does need to be fleshed out and communicated to the community at all levels. To that end, Yoni knows this. I shared this article with him. I did write a very long article, which is in the process of being published, to that end. But I think, yes, you know, I'm not going to get into all the legal details. But, you know, Lashon Hara can't be used to allow people who should be exposed to hide behind Lashon Hara. I think that's definitely correct. The related point, I would say that there's a response by Rabbi Moshe Sternbach, one of the senior rabbis in the Haredi community in Israel, in his Tshuvot B'Hanagot, volume 7, number 192, where he quotes from the Satmar Rebbe that from why is it that we know that Abraham went to bat for Sodom, for the evils of Sodom, before God. So why did he, you know, bat between him and, you know, I don't always love these questions, but he asked, right, why did he go to bat for Sodom before God and not before people? And he said, it's very simple. Because when he's talking to God, he can judge people favorably as much as he wants. Right? It doesn't matter that they were the most corrupt people in the world. Right? They are the paradigm of corruption. Between you and God, you can judge people favorably as much as you want. But if he would do the same thing to other people, it wouldn't come across as judging favorably. It would come across as condoning. So the Satmar Rebbe argued that while in your personal life, in your own mind, you should give people the benefit of the doubt, once corruption is beginning to become public, if you don't take the active step and decry it, then you're condoning it. There's, you know, you can't be silent. And therefore, he argues that in that case, it would be obligatory so that we aren't seen as condoning it. So, you know, we've talked about some of the negatives that, you know, we have to balance. Is this really for the public good? Is there another way of doing it? And that has to be taken into account. But yes, I think using the laws of Lashon Hara to protect the abuser over the victim, I think, is a misconstrual of Jewish law.
Take one last one here, and it's for Rabbi Ziering. I also want to make sure to note that that the recording will be available on yutorah.org, that's the audio, and the video on koshertube.com, courtesy of Rabbi David Ostricker. There is a classic midrash in which the sages speak of God deciding whether to create man or not create man, and different attributes of God argue in different directions. And in this midrash, it's actually a tie between divine attributes, and God takes the trait of emet, of truth, and casts it down to the ground, defeating it in the debate. And obviously, there's a lot to say about this midrash. But the question is, do you see this in any way as applicable to the issue of the duty of the press?
So, briefly, yes, again. I'll give this very, very quickly. There are many journalists, and you know, Yoni can speak to whether he's among them, who think that basically the prime value, you know, when we're talking about you know, public discourse, is truth. A truth is the ultimate value, and everything else is subservient to it. So, you know, if truth comes into conflict with peace, or conflict of you know, the protection of you know, of related family members and the like, it doesn't matter, right? The job of the press in the extreme is just to be sunlight, indiscriminate sunlight, and that's the best disinfectant. I don't know whether Yoni believes this, and it doesn't sound like he believes this, at least in its extreme form. That position, I think, is not one that can be accepted by Jewish law. There are many, many sources that note that in Jewish law we see truth as a value in a pantheon of values which have to be balanced, and sometimes truth wins out and sometimes something else wins out. For example, the Talmud in Yevamot 65b says that we're allowed to lie for peace, which tells you that at least sometimes the value of peace is going to override the value of, let's say, truth, or let's call it transparency for now. The Gemara in Sanhedrin 6 says that, notes in the context of courts, that there seems to be an eternal a struggle between justice, which in many places is equated with truth, right, the exacting of truth, and again, peace. The Gemara in Bava Metzia 23b notes that there are three things that we allow Torah scholars to lie for. One of them is issues relating to their marital life, meaning there are certain things that just aren't supposed to be publicized because they're private. In a certain sense, privacy overrides purely the value of truth. Another thing the Gemara brings up there is he's allowed to lie about how much he knows, because humility is a value that overrides truth. There are other Gemaras. There's even a wonderful tshuva in the Torah Lishma, which is an anonymous work which is normally ascribed to the Ben Ish Chai under a pseudonym, Shin Samach Dalet 364, where someone asked him, "Can you give me the rubric for when truth wins out over other values and when other values win over truth?" And he says, "Sure." And he said, "Here, what I'm not going to tell you the answer. What I'm going to do is I'm going to list to you every place in the Talmud, medieval commentaries, and later commentaries where they deal with this question, and trust you to be able to figure out what the answer is based on that information." So I'm not going to try to give an answer, but I think it's definitely the case that sources like the Midrash and related passages do note that Jewish ethics struggle with the balance between truth and other values and transparency and other values. And if we wanted to develop a full ethic of journalism, shall we say, from the halachic perspective, our goal would be to balance them and not automatically, shall we say, give first place to truth and transparency.
I want to thank both of our panelists for addressing all these questions. As we are nearing Rosh Hashanah, a day when we think a lot about truth, and a day when we also think about our speech in the course of the year and the way that we used our power of speech, it's worth thinking about these questions not only in terms of the responsibilities of a newspaper, but frankly in terms of the responsibilities each of us bear in our own private media loudspeaker, our emails that we send out, our conversations with others in shul, not during davening, but conversations that occur in the shul building. But I think it's really worthwhile for us to ask ourselves these questions about how we decide what to say and what not to say, where it is useful, where it is productive, and so on. Rochelle, if you could please come up to speak about your father, Dov Ben Mordechai, in whose memory we've had this program this evening.
That was great. Thank you. And Yoni Goldstein, your lovely mother and I spent many hours in the women's balcony of Clinton Park Synagogue half a decade ago. It's an interesting journey from there to here. The title of tonight's discussion, Judaism and Journalism, has evoked a very strong memory for me. It's the memory of my father diligently reading the newspaper every evening. This daily ritual took a long time. I'm pretty sure he read every page, every word, except for the comics and the sports section. Every now and then, my father would look up at me from his reading and ask, "Mamala, do you know what this word means?" And he would carefully spell out a word like geopolitical or epiphany. It touches me to remember this. There was a quality of humility in his asking and in his need to interpret, an openness in his need to interpret and understand every single word. My brother Ellie, whom I think many of you know, shares this memory. Our father, remembered as Bela Rubinstein or Bill Rubinstein or Dov of Beit Midrash Zichron Dov, often said that he was a simple, uneducated man. Yet, he successfully tackled the challenges of facing great loss and of life in a new world with a new language. He did this by working hard, by caring for his family and his community, and by paying close attention to people and to their words. And he made up for his lack of schooling by really studying the Globe and Mail and the Canadian Jewish News. To me, our father's newspaper reading was a ritual intertwined in my memory with his daily davening ritual. The davening was comforting in its repetition and in its unchanging structure that linked him to both his beloved lost family and to all contemporary Jews who said the exact same words that he did every day. The newspaper reading was also about discovery and questionings and a search for truth. This dedication to reading, in order to unravel and interpret mysteries, confusions, and contradictions, was shared by our mother, Judith, or Judith, or Judy, or Judy Naney, who became a writer as well as an avid reader. So it's not surprising that my brother Ellie and my daughter Alicia have become writers, too. Or that all the generations of Bill and Judith's offspring enjoy poring over an interesting text. These qualities are shared by many of you here tonight, fellow supporters of Beit Midrash Zichron Dov. My thanks and appreciation to all of you.
Rochelle, thank you very much. Everyone is welcome to, well, first of all, to stay for Maariv. We'll be putting the mechitza back for Maariv. There are refreshments out in the lobby. Please, please take some refreshments. Thank you very much. Ekseva v'chasima tova. We should be inscribed and sealed for a wonderful year.